Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, we are studying Majjhima Nikaya number 7, the Vatupama Sutta, the simile of the cloth. And last time I went through the list of the 16 Chitupa Kilesas, the 16 defilements or corruptions of the mind. And according to the text, as we continue, we read that we're in paragraph 4 now, when the bhikkhu, the monk, knows that each of the 16 defilements is a defilement, a corruption, an imperfection that defiles the mind, then he abandons it. And the text here, it's expressed very, very concisely. It might seem that if you just read the text and just take it at its face value, that all one has to do is be aware of the defilement in the mind, and automatically one abandons it. We could understand that within this word, knowing the defilement and abandoning it, there is compressed the entire process of training that leads to the abandoning of that defilement. We could understand here, first of all, what is called the abandoning by factor substitution, or the temporary abandoning of the defilement. Okay, one is aware that these particular states are defilements of the mind, and so one makes an effort in one's day-to-day life to prevent them from arising. We can call this a kind of abandoning by way of factor substitution. One is making an effort to prevent these factors from arising just by applying the effort on each occasion when the particular defilement tends to arise. Then one undertakes the training in samadhi. Through concentration, one focuses the mind upon a single object, some object conducive to the attainment of concentration, some object which enables one to collect the forces of the mind and bring them to a state of one-pointed unification. And as one develops the samadhi, then the defilements of the mind are inhibited. Their activity is checked, and they're brought into a state of what we call suppression, vikambana. Then from samadhi, one turns to the development of insight. And as one develops insight, again, as the insight knowledges arise, the defilements are prevented from becoming active. And this activity of the way insight inhibits or prevents the arising of the defilements, this is another form of abandoning through factor substitution. But now it is the moment by moment activation of wisdom that prevents the defilements from entering the mind. And whenever one of these defilements does find the opportunity to arise, immediately one brings to bear the awareness that this defilement is a corruption of the mind and expels that defilement from the mind. Then as wisdom reaches deeper and deeper into an understanding of the true nature of things, into the impermanent, unsatisfactory, selfless nature of things, eventually one reaches the supramundane or world-transcending paths and fruits, and it's through the wisdom inherent to those path attainments that one cuts off permanently, irreversibly, these defilements of the mind. The initial path attainment that cuts off defilements is that of stream entry. That cuts off one layer of the defilements. The second layer is with the attainment of once-returnership, the state of a once-returner. Third layer is that of the non-returner. And the fourth and final stage is that of the non-returner, at which point all of the defilements are cut off permanently and irreversibly. But here in this text, according to the commentaries, the Buddha is speaking not about an arahant, but about those at the lower stages of attainment, at maximum the stage of non-returner. And that this is in fact the case, we can see from the fact that later in the sutta, the Buddha will explain how a disciple who has reached this, in paragraph 5, that point of abandoning the defilements, has to go further in order to reach the destruction of the asavas, the destruction of the taints or influxes, and thereby attain perfect, complete liberation. So the monk who's being described in paragraphs 4, 5, and so on cannot be an arhat. Okay, so in paragraph 5, we read that each sentence in this paragraph partly repeats what has come in the previous paragraph, but now it is stated in the past tense. When a bhikkhu has known that covetousness and unrighteous greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, when he has known that ill will, negligence, and then all of the other defilements are included here, is an imperfection that defiles the mind and has abandoned it, then I'll translate more literally than it's done here. Then he becomes endowed, possessed of unshakable confidence in the Buddha. Thus, then we have the standard formula describing the sublime qualities of the Buddha. The Buddha, the Blessed One, is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, the enlightened one, the blessed one. Then he becomes one who is possessed of unshakable or confirmed confidence in the Dhamma. Thus, the Dhamma is well proclaimed by the Blessed One, visible here and now, immediate, inviting investigation, onward leading, to be experienced by the wise for themselves. He becomes one who is possessed of unshakable confidence in the Sangha. Thus, in the standard description of the noble Sangha, the Sangha consisting of the four pairs of persons, that is, the four noble ones who are divided according to whether they are on the path to the attainment, and those who have reached the attainment itself, that is, the one on the path to stream entry and the stream enterer, the one on the path to once return and the once returner, the one on the path to non-returner and the non-returner, the one on the path to arhatship and the arhat. Okay, so these three qualities that are being described here, unshakable confidence in the Buddha, unshakable confidence in the Dharma, unshakable confidence in the Aryan Sangha, the Noble Sangha, these are three of the four factors that constitute stream entry, the lowest stage of the four, the lowest of the four stages of noble attainment. And so one, when the disciple is being described in this way, we know that he is at minimum a stream enterer. The fourth quality of the stream enterer is observance of the virtues or moral precepts dear to the noble ones without any breach or flaw in their observance. And this is usually taken to mean perfect observance of the five precepts. Yeah, this word avecha basada translated here as perfect confidence, but I prefer to take it as confirmed confidence, has a somewhat interesting derivation. The Pali avecha is a gerund, we call it a gerund, based upon a verb that I don't think it occurs at all in the normal form in Pali, but it would be aveti, which means literally to undergo, in the sense of to know. So avecha, the gerund form, means having undergone, having, in the sense of having known or having understood. And prasada means confidence, trust, or conviction. So avecha prasada is the confidence that arises through, as a result of having undergone the experience of realizing the truth of the Dhamma, the truth of the Buddha's teaching. Before one reaches that stage, one can have very deep and sincere prasada, confidence in the Buddha's teaching. One can have very deep and sincere saddha, faith in the Buddha's teaching. But it is only when a person goes through the attainment of sotapatti, stream entry, that they become endowed of, that they become endowed with or possessed of avecha prasada, this unshakable or confirmed confidence in the triple gem. Because they have seen the Dhamma, so they know the Dhamma is true. And therefore they know that the Buddha is an enlightened one, and that the Sangha, those who have practiced the Dhamma, have realized the same truth that they themselves have experienced and seen. And when they gain this confidence, they therefore know that all the qualities that are traditionally ascribed to the Buddha are true. It doesn't mean that they fully fathom the depth and range of the Buddha's enlightenment, but they know that the Buddha is the one who is fully and perfectly enlightened. And since they have seen the Dhamma for themselves, they know that the Dhamma is well proclaimed. They have seen the Dhamma. They know that it is visible, that it can be seen. They know that it is akaliko, something which is not a matter of time, that is something to be known immediately, that it can be known in this very life, that they know that it is ahipasiko, something that one comes to and sees for oneself, that it is opanayako, which I now understand to mean something that one applies to one's own life, that one applies to one's existence, and thereby sees for oneself. And they know that it is pachatang veditabo vinyuhiti, that it is something to be experienced by the wise for themselves. Similarly, they have this confidence in the Aryan Sangha. Not usually when we speak about the Sangha, we refer to the order of monks and nuns, but that is just the conventional Sangha. Sangha, the word Sangha here is used in a conventional sense. But in the deeper sense, the Aryan Sangha is the invisible spiritual community of all of those who partake of the Buddha's enlightenment, who share in that enlightenment by reaching some stage of realization by which they have seen the same truths that the Buddha himself has seen. Okay, now we come to paragraph 8. And this is an important paragraph. And it introduces an interesting expression. The text says, and I like to take the Pali text. It says, yatodi kopanasa chattang hoti vantang mutang pahinang pati nisatang so bhute avecha pasadena samanagato amhiti labhati attavedang labhati dhammavedang labhati dham upasanghitang pamujang. Then continues. Pamudi tasa piti jayati piti manasa kayo pasambati pasada kayo sukang vedeti sukino chitang samadhiati. Okay, the important word here is this word yatodi, which is translated here very roughly in part. And there's a note 90, which points to a variation in readings. Actually, there's a difference in the reading followed in this translation and in the Pali Text Society's edition. But the sense is, whatever reading is followed, the sense is that the defilements have been abandoned only up to a certain limit. They haven't been completely eradicated in their totality. And the implication seems to be that the disciples have abandoned, given up, expelled the defilements according, each one according to their own degree of attainment. Some of them will be stream enterers, and so they have abandoned the defilements to the limit to which a stream enterer will abandon them. Some will be once returners. They will have abandoned the defilements more to a greater extent, but only to the extent of a once returner. And some will be non-returners who have abandoned the defilements even more fully, but still only up to the extent to which a non-returner abandons them. But what is true for all of them is that none of them have abandoned the defilements, anodhi, the Pali word, anodhi, which means without any restrictions, without any limits. Okay, when the disciple sees, reflects upon his own mind, and sees that the defilements have been abandoned in part, and then considers that he possesses this unshakable confidence in the Buddha, he now knows that he is on the path, the definite, irreversible path to final liberation. There's no possibility now of falling back into the plane of the ordinary person, the common worldling. No possibility of falling back to taking rebirth into the lower planes of existence. And if that disciple doesn't go any further in this life, no possibility of taking more than 7 more rebirths within samsara. And so considering all of this now, and then especially focusing upon this perfect confidence in the Buddha, now the disciple gains what is called Attaveda, Dhammaveda, Dhammupasanghita Pamojang. Here we have these Pali expressions, very difficult. It's very difficult to render them precisely, exactly into English. But we try to do so with this expression. Attaveda, we say, gains inspiration in the meaning. But this word atta in Pali has several layers of meaning, so that when we translate it as meaning, when we've translated it into English as meaning, it comes out rather flat. The word atta, or Sanskrit arta, suggests on the one hand meaning, like we say the meaning of a term is its atta, but also it suggests goal, purpose, so that the goal of the Buddha's path is its atta. And then atta also suggests the way that the goal of the path is something that bounces back or reflects back upon our life and gives meaning and purpose to our life. So it is not just a goal way out there in the distance, something to which we are moving gradually, slowly, or swiftly over time, but we could also see it as something which is permeating and pervading our life right now with its own brilliance, with its own luminosity. And so it is this meaningfulness of the goal that gives meaning, purpose, value to our life. And it is this that also permeates the path and the practice. And so as one reflects upon one's abandoning of the defilements and one's confidence in the Buddha, one gains also this word Veda also has a rich meaning. On the one hand, it suggests the ancient Indian scriptures, which are called the Vedas, the scriptures which constitute the foundation for Hinduism. The Buddha, of course, rejected the authority of the Vedas and refused to accept them as having any kind of supernatural stature. He didn't believe that they were divinely revealed. But this word Veda carries over a very powerful meaning in Indian spirituality. And the Buddha took this word with all of its with his other connotations and incorporated it into his own system. The word Veda, on the one hand, comes from the root vid, which on the one hand suggests vijati, to know, giving us the noun vija, meaning knowledge. And on the other hand, it suggests vedeti, the verb vedeti, which means to feel, and from which we get the noun vedana, feeling. So Veda is a feeling imbued with knowledge, or a knowledge permeated, pervaded by feeling. And so we try to capture this dual meaning with the word inspiration. It's a kind of joyous inspiration. And in this case, it's a joyous inspiration, a joyous knowing inspiration that comes through understanding and feeling the meaning of the love of one's life, that has been generated by penetrating the truth of the Buddha's teaching. One also gains this inspiration in the Dhamma. Again, this is a joyous, knowing inspiration that comes from fathoming the teaching, from penetrating and understanding the teaching. And this is made more explicit, this aspect of joy, of happiness, of joyfulness, by the next phrase, one gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. Dhammupasanghita pamoja. And now when the text introduces this word gladness, that provides the cue or starting point for another sequence that we often meet time and again within the suttas. Here the sequence is gladness. Again, gladness is a very weak attempt to translate the word pamoja. Pamoja is perhaps better translated as joy. In English we say glad, we see a friend that we haven't seen for some time, I'm glad. We get a letter from somebody, I'm glad. But that's a very trivial type of gladness. But this is a gladness, really a joy that comes from reaching the final goal of human existence from beginningless time. And so now one is really delighted, gladdened, uplifted, ecstatic. And that gladness becomes the starting point for an evolving process of development. Actually, that's a redundancy. It becomes a starting point for a process of development. Okay, so from this gladness, as it intensifies, it turns into rapture, piti. So joy becomes more and more intense, more and more focused, until it turns into rapture. Rapture is this joy so strong, so concentrated, that it seems as though it is flooding through the whole body, the whole mind, uplifting them, permeating them, just the way a mass of flooding water might flood over a countryside, or as though air might fill a balloon. But rapture, joy and rapture, have something of an exciting or an exhilarating quality to them. And therefore, from the higher standpoint, they are somewhat defective states. In the initial stages, they are really, compared to our ordinary, insipid, flat states of mind, they are something wonderful, amazing, beautiful and wonderful. But from the higher standpoint, from the standpoint of wisdom, they are defective. And so, using the perspective of the Dhamma, one has to see that they are defective and stand back from them. Cultivate them, bring them to a certain peak of development, then detach from them and let them settle down until they become replaced by tranquility. That is the next step, pasaddhi. So rapture gives rise to tranquility. Tranquility comes first into the mind. When the mind becomes tranquil, then the body becomes tranquil and settles down. As the body becomes tranquil and settles down, then pleasure or happiness becomes prominent. Pleasure or happiness is different from joy, different from that rapture. It's quieter, just the feeling of pure, sheer pleasure, sheer happiness. And as one is feeling this quiet, tranquil happiness, this quiet pleasure, the mind becomes concentrated. Chittam samadhiyati. This is samadhi. Okay, now the Buddha makes an interesting statement. He says, if, we're in paragraph 12, if a monk of such virtue, of such Dhamma, here the word Dhamma we can understand to refer to concentration, samadhi, and such wisdom eats alms food consisting of choice hill rice along with various sauces and curries, even that will be no obstacle for him. Then he uses a simile, just as a cloth that is defiled and stained becomes pure and bright with the help of clear water, or just as gold becomes pure and bright with the help of a furnace, so too if a monk of such virtue and so on eats alms food with various sauces and curries, that will be no obstacle for him. And the way I would understand this passage, I would understand this passage to be stating obliquely that the monk being described here is a non-returner. And I understand it for this reason, that the rice, the choice rice with the various sauces and curries, very delicious, and that is a tantalizing sense pleasure. And so for an ordinary monk, or ordinary person who's eating such rice, it will stimulate, who's eating such food, it will stimulate sensual desire, sensual enjoyment. And for a trainer, a person who's training on the path, that will be an obstacle. But for one who has reached the stage of non-returner, sensual desire has been eradicated. And so such a person can eat this delicious food and won't have any attachment to it, won't have any craving for it, but can continue with his training just as if he were eating ordinary food. Okay, so now we have a disciple at the stage of highest non-returning. But if we take those still at the lower stages, we could take the disciples at any of the lower stages of attainment. And now the text is going to show us how such a disciple practices to reach the stage of arhatship. And here the Buddha brings in the four Brahmaviharas. And he's going to show how this disciple uses the Brahmaviharas as means for developing samadhi, concentration, and then uses that concentration as a foundation for developing insight. That is, for developing vipassana. Okay, the text reads, he abides pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness, likewise the second, the third, the fourth, so above, below, around, and everywhere, and to all as to himself, he abides pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. And then the same formula is repeated for compassion, karuna, altruistic joy, mudita, and equanimity, upeka. These four states are called, collectively they're called the four immeasurable states, because they are ideally to be extended immeasurably, to extend to all sentient beings. They're also called the four Brahmaviharas, the four divine abodes, because they are said to be the dwelling places, the states in which the divinities, the Brahmas, the high divinities, dwell. The four states have somewhat different aspects. The state of loving kindness is basically the wish for the welfare and happiness of others. It is the desire springing up from the depths of the heart that all living beings will be well, physically well, that they will be free from all harm and danger, that they will enjoy peace and happiness of mind. Karuna, compassion, is the quality of heart that makes one tremble or shake with the sufferings of others, that makes one feel deeply with the sufferings of others. Mudita is the converse of this. Mudita literally means joy, but it's not just ordinary joy, but we translate it as altruistic joy. It is the joy of rejoicing with the good fortune and success of others, or it is rejoicing in the good qualities of others. Instead of regarding the success and happiness and good fortune of others with envy and resentment, one, by identifying inwardly with others, one is able to rejoice in their success. One knocks down that barrier of the competitive mind, the resentful mind, and feels the same happiness that the person who succeeds, who is happy, themselves will feel. And then the mind of equanimity is the mind which looks upon other beings with detachment and impartiality. It's not the mind of cold indifference, but it is the mind which is not swayed by feelings of partiality, favoritism, or any kind of bias towards beings. And it's also the mind which cannot be really upset and disturbed by changes in the fortunes of others. The state of equanimity is compatible with metta, with loving kindness, with compassion, and with altruistic joy. So at the time that the mind is in equanimity, in upeka, it will not at the same time be in metta or in compassion or in altruistic joy. The four different states of mind, a person can have access to all four of them, and one who has developed them will have access to all four of them. And one doesn't supplant the others, but ideally the four will be present in the same person at different times, and each will lend its flavor to the personality of that person. Okay, so the monk who's being discussed here takes one of these, or according to the sutta, takes all four of them as his vehicle of meditation. And each of these subjects of meditation can be developed to the level of jhana. And one does so by developing that particular quality universally, not just developing it to a limited number of people, but after focusing it on particular people till one builds up that quality, then one extends it first by radiating it to the directions, then one extends it from the directions universally till it pervades the whole world. And as one radiates the loving kindness, the compassion throughout the whole world, even the thoughts of love, compassion, and so on vanish, and the mind just becomes completely absorbed in that feeling tone of love, compassion, or altruistic joy or equanimity, until the mind becomes utterly absorbed in that state. And that becomes the entryway to the jhana. And then the meditator will consolidate that jhana, become very firmly, solidly, well established in that jhana. Now, if the meditator remains content with the jhana, with the samadhi based on one of these four qualities, then and doesn't go further by developing wisdom, then when death takes place, the meditator's mind will take rebirth in one of the divine states of the realm of pure form in the Brahma world, and will remain there for many, many aeons, but will eventually pass away and take rebirth elsewhere, and then go migrating, passing on and on within samsara. And so for Buddhism, the final goal, for the Buddha Dharma, the final goal is not just simply to develop one of the four divine abodes, but one has to go further than this by developing wisdom. And that is what is being indicated in the next paragraph here, paragraph 17, the development of insight or wisdom. And that is being expressed very, very concisely. But within that very concise expression, there is very, very deep meaning. Okay, the text says, he understands thus. There is this. There is the inferior. There is the superior. And beyond, there is an escape from this whole field of perception. In the words of the Pali, it says, so ati idam, ati hinam, ati panitam, ati imasa, sanyagatasa, uttering ni sarananti pajanati. Okay, what is being expressed here? What is being expressed is the understanding of the Four Noble Truths based upon the attainment of a jhana through the Brahma Viharas, through the divine abodes. Okay, when the text says, there is this, that is pointing to the meditative state based on one of the four divine abodes. And here I have to say that in order to understand this, we have to use the commentary, which is very, very helpful. Okay, what the meditator does now, he attains the divine abode, enters it, abides, dwells within it for some time, till he becomes familiar with it, then emerges from it. After emerging from it, he examines it now with wisdom. He looks back upon that attainment of the divine abode, that meditative absorption, and investigates what was that experience. And he sees that within that experience, what was present? What was present was a feeling, generally a very pleasant feeling. There was present a perception, perceiving the object of that meditative absorption. There were present many mental formations, many sankharas, volitional formations. And there was present consciousness, the awareness of the whole experience. And all of this was occurring based upon or rooted in this physical body, especially based upon what is called the heart base, the hadyavattu. That is the particular place within the body which is the source from which consciousness arises. The commentators identify this with the heart, but not the physical heart that beats, but it is a type of matter located or superimposed upon the physical heart, a type of subtle matter, and it is from this that consciousness arises. That is the view of the commentaries. We don't have to take it literally. Perhaps using modern physiology, we could see it as referring to the whole brain and nervous system. But the important point is that there is a physical basis for mind and consciousness, and there are the various mental functions. And when we take these mental functions, we have feeling, perception, volitional formations, and consciousness. And when we consider all of these together, we see that all of them constitute the five aggregates. Then we ask, where do these five aggregates originate from? What is their root? What is their productive cause? what brings them into existence. What brings them into existence? Okay. These five aggregates, let me backtrack. These five aggregates together that make up the Brahma Vihara, the divine abode, that is the meaning of there is this. Then we inquire, what is the productive cause from which these five aggregates originate? The productive cause from which they originate is craving. Craving is what is pointed to by the expression, there is the inferior. That is the second noble truth. Craving is what is low, what is defective. And craving, in turn, originates from ignorance. And so in this way, we trace the chain of causation. From ignorance comes craving. From craving comes clinging. From clinging, we engage in various karmic actions. And all of these together bring about the production of renewed existence from life to life, bringing into being the five aggregates. That is the process of samsara. And so we are now understanding the first and second noble truths. Then there is the superior, atti panitam. The way I would understand it, here I differ from the commentary. The commentary says the panitang, the superior, is the fourth noble truth, the Noble Eightfold Path. As I see it, the superior, what is excellent or superior, is the third noble truth, nibbana. Nibbana is elsewhere in the suttas, very often it's called, this is the peaceful, this is the superior, that is the stilling of all formations, the relinquishing of all points of attachment, dispassion, cessation, nibbana. And then the escape from this whole field of perception. The commentary says that that is nibbana. But as I understand it, that is the fourth noble truth, the Noble Eightfold Path that leads to the superior, that leads to nibbana, that leads out from this whole field of perception, from everything conditioned, from everything compounded and composite. Okay, so now the monk applies the understanding of the Four Noble Truths to this experience of the Brahma Vihara. And having done so, he contemplates the factors of the Brahma Vihara, these five aggregates that make up the Brahma Vihara as subject to arising and falling. They're conditioned, they're unsatisfactory, bound to break up, they break up and fall away, and so they are not worth clinging to. And when he's knowing and seeing thus, his mind is liberated from the taint of sensual desire. His mind is liberated from the taint of being, the taint of craving for existence. His mind is liberated from the taint of ignorance. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge it is liberated, and he understands birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming back to any state of being. And now in this sutta, the Buddha must have known that there was one Brahmin sitting in the audience who had a special tendency or strong connection to go forth and become a monk and reach arhatship. But this Brahmin was had a very strong conviction that purification comes through bathing. And so the Buddha used one statement as a kind of skillful means to awaken his interest in the Dhamma. The Buddha said, "This monk is called one bathed with the inner bathing." And when the Buddha said that, then the Brahmin's interest was aroused, and he asked the Buddha, "But does Master Gotama go to the Bahuka River to bathe?" And then the Buddha said, "Why should I go to the Bahuka River to bathe? What can the Bahuka River do?" And the word Bahuka means many. The word Bahuka means many. So it's literally the many river, the river to which many people go. And the reason the Brahmin explained is that the Bahuka River is held by many to give liberation. It's held by many to give merit, and many people wash away their evil deeds by bathing in the Bahuka River. And then in reply, the Buddha addressed the Brahmin with some verses in which he stated that it was, in effect, he stated that it's pointless to try to bathe away one's evil deeds in the rivers, but rather the real process of cleansing comes by bathing with the practice of the Noble Path. And when the Buddha had said this, then the Brahmin expressed his delight and joy. He took refuge in the Buddha and his teaching. He went forth as a monk, and before long he attained arhatship. And that marks the end of the discourse. Okay, and now we will share the merit with the devas and with the other beings. Akasata jabumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata deva nagamahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata ca ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadang punya sampadang sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Etavata ca ammehi sampadang.